I am told we have a quorum, so I am going to call the meeting to order. I want to note at the end of this meeting, we have a closed session among members of the Faculty Senate only. We're going to try to start that by 4:45, so we are going to try to move through business in a reasonably prompt manner in order to get there. Let me ask everyone to rise as you are able for the reading of memorial resolutions. And I will recognize Professor Regina Murphy to present the memorial resolution for Professor Emeritus Ed Lightfoot.
Okay. Edwin Ed Lightfoot died in Madison on October 2nd at the age of 92. He was preceded in death by his wife of 67 years, Lila, and is survived by their five children, one of whom is here, Ted, and one granddaughter. Ed's extraordinary academic career spanned from 1953 until his retirement in 1996. With Bob Byrd and Warren Stewart, he co-authored a textbook, Transport Phenomena, a text that transformed chemical engineering curricula worldwide. Ed's research in biological mass transport, bioseparations, and systems biology was world-renowned. He was a dedicated teacher and devoted mentor to his students. Ed was elected to the National Academy of Engineering and the National Academy of Sciences, and was the recipient of the National Medal of Science from President Bush. Ed was a prolific reader who was able to expound on almost any topic. He spent many happy hours at his Sauk County cabin with family, friends, and his much-loved dogs. He will be deeply missed.
And I want to thank Ed's son, Ted Lightfoot, for being here today. Thank you for coming. Please be seated. Let everyone get seated here who's still coming in. I'm going to make a few remarks, and then I'm going to turn the podium over to Marcia Malik, the Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education, and then we will do questions at the end of both of those sets of comments. So there are always a number of good news happening around campus, and this afternoon we have quite a bit of particularly good news. Let me start with the fact that five of our professors have earned American Association for Advancement of Science fellowships. Named to the AAAS are Amy Barger, Professor of Astronomy, John Berry, Professor of Chemistry, Jack Ma, Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering, Jeanette Roberts, Professor of Pharmacy, and Lydia Zapita, Professor of Consumer Science. Congratulations to all of them. Scott Strauss in Political Science recently was announced as the winner of the Graumeier Award for his book on genocide in Africa. Two of our students were finalists for the Rhodes Scholarship. Kyra Fox from Whitefish Bay is a double major in International Studies and Psychology, and Russ Dahlke of Westfield, Wisconsin is double majoring in Journalism and Political Science. And just this morning, we announced that Phoenix Rice Johnson is a Marshall Scholar winner. Phoenix graduated in 2016 with honors and a degree in Political Science and International Studies. Segueing from faculty and honors, I need to say a word about the athletic season. Despite a disappointing loss to Ohio State in Indianapolis on Saturday night, our Badger football team has just had an outstanding season, going undefeated up until the Big Ten championship game, and as I hope you all know, we'll be playing in the Orange Bowl in Miami, Florida on December 30th. I'm particularly proud of Coach Christ and all that he has accomplished, and has been named the Big Ten Coach of the Year for the second year in a row. I will also note that if you look at other schools that are competing at the same level as we are, we clearly have higher levels of academic achievement among our football team than among other top-ranked teams, and that's just as important as our success on the field. So the Badger football team joins Duke, Northwestern, and Stanford as the only four football programs in Division I to earn academic public recognition awards in each of the last 5 years. And doing that at the same time that they've accomplished what they have on the field is something that I am quite proud of. And not wanting to dwell only on football, I should note that the women's volleyball team is having another great year under Coach Kelly Sheffield. They're playing Stanford on Friday night in the Sweet 16 round of the NCAA tournament. And our men's soccer team also got to the Sweet 16 round in their NCAA championship. So a good fall for all of the Badger teams. Marsha will say more about this. We just recently received our rankings on research expenditures. And again, we came in the same as last year, sixth in the nation. Being in the top 10 is a good place to be. I'd rather be in the top five, which is where we have been for many years. But Marsha will talk further about where we are and some of the good news around that. I think both she and I feared we might be dropping further yet this year, given some of the trends over the last 10 years. And I think we've finally got evidence we're turning some of those trends around. One of the things that I'm very pleased to announce, I don't know if all of you have heard this yet, as you know, we are underpaying our graduate students compared to many of our peers. And we're going to take an opportunity this year when we don't have budget cuts. And again, as I've said this before, we're beginning to see some returns from some of the revenue generating strategies that we have implemented here. And the result is that we're going to, I think this has been announced, a significant stipend increase for graduate student teaching and project assistance, which is absolutely vital to our research competitiveness and to our faculty who work with these students. The increase is going to be 13.3% in current stipends. That raises the campus minimum from $16,196 to $18,350 for 9-month 50% appointments. And I want to thank our provost, Bill Karpis in the graduate school, Marsha, and Lorraine Heller, the VCFA, for their work on this issue. And we're still not where we need to be, but we have an opportunity this year to move up substantially, and we need to take that opportunity. So I think that's good news. As you know, in its November meeting, the Board of Regents voted to make UW Cooperative Extension a part of UW-Madison, I should say, to make it again a part of UW-Madison. A Cooperative Extension was founded here on this campus, was part of us for, I think, more than 50 years before it moved into this new organization that the system then created with Extension and the two-year schools. Just this morning, I participated in a statewide call with Cooperative Extension employees to welcome them, and I'm really quite glad to see this change happen. I think if we do it right, it will be a win-win for both Cooperative Extension and for us, that they can benefit with closer collaborations across our campus with all of the work that's going on here, and we can benefit in terms of our outreach around the state by collaborating more with them. So I'm excited about this. The plan is almost surely we would move them in as a new unit. There are more than 600 employees in Cooperative Extension. So we would basically add another, I don't know if it's going to be called a school or a college or whatever, and a dean who would be in charge of that. And then it can work across campus and collaborate with all other units here as well. The provost is in charge of making all this integration go smoothly, and she in turn has appointed Casey Nagy, who some of you will know as John Wiley's chief of staff from a decade or more ago, to lead the transition effort. And we've also asked Heidi Zorb, who has long been part of CALS but has been over at Extension doing some work in the recent past, to be directly involved in the transition process. So we're setting up working groups to work on the whole set of governance, HR, IT, financial, all of those issues that are getting involved in the transition. There will be staff and faculty from Extension in those groups. There will be staff and faculty from Madison in those groups. And you know, we will work as quickly as we can. I'm not sure we're going to get everything done by July 1st. There are going to be some elements of this reorganization that will take longer. But the goal is to start functionally operating with Cooperative Extension as part of UW-Madison by July 1st, the beginning of the next fiscal year. So this is going to be a big project, but I think it's a project that's well worth doing and will result in good things. A word about federal taxation and the reform plans. As you know, there has been tax legislation passed in both the House and the Senate. Those plans are different, and they're now going into reconciliation. There are a variety of aspects in these plans which will very much impact universities. In my opinion, the most impactful is the proposal in the House to actually tax waived tuition for graduate students. That would seriously reduce the number of students who could afford to attend graduate programs around the country. This is in the House bill, but it's not in the Senate bill. This is one where I think everyone, and not just in this room, but around the country, needs to keep commenting and keep the pressure up on this. I think we have a good chance of this not coming out of reconciliation, since it's not in both bills, but we have to keep messaging the cost of this one. There's a whole variety of other bills. I have communicated with our national representatives by letter. I've talked to a number of them face-to-face. A number of the higher education groups that we are working with have been actively involved, and I know profs and others are involved in this one as well, and it's one that we should care quite a bit about. Turning from taxation to sexual harassment, lots of good topics today. As everyone here knows, there's been an ongoing national conversation on sexual harassment and on gender discrimination in workplaces, including here at UW-Madison. And I just want to affirm the commitment of this university to an environment that is safe and free from harassment and intimidation. In 2015, we were part of an AAU survey on sexual assault and on misconduct. We asked about experiences of harassment. That's not assault, that's simply being treated differentially and in a negative way because of your gender. And half of our students reported having experienced harassment. That is something that we need to take seriously. We've taken a number of actions since then to effectively prevent and respond to harassment. Number one, created a new full-time Title IX coordinator position in 2015, placing that position in the newly created Office of Compliance. We're requiring sexual harassment and sexual assault prevention training for all graduate students. We launched that pilot in 2016. We made it mandatory in 2017. Undergraduate students have been required to take this training since 2013, and slightly different training for graduate students than for undergraduates. We are requiring, as you all know, sexual harassment, sexual assault prevention training for all employees beginning last July. If any of you or anyone in your units have not completed that, they will not be eligible for any of the wage adjustments that are going to be coming down the line this year or next. So it's very important that people complete that training. As of early November, about 90% of our employees had already done so. We have created updated policies on sexual harassment, including better defining which university employees are Title IX responsible employees, and we've adopted a new policy and grievance procedure to address hostile, intimidating behavior. You are all involved in that, and you're going to be asked to confirm or support or not support the other new policy later in this meeting. And we've hired two additional victim advocates in the fall of 2016 in survivor services. It is absolutely essential that individuals, departments, schools, colleges, and the entire university not only respond appropriately to all complaints and concerns about sexual harassment and sexual assault, but work proactively to create the positive and inclusive environment for students, staff, and faculty that we all want to see. And you know, here in Bascom Hall, we don't know what's happening out there in a lot of places. The deans often don't know, and it is on people at the ground level to report things, to try to deal with them, to try to see if there are ways, first within the department, and if that doesn't work, through a more formal procedure to address issues as they arise. And everyone has it on their shoulders to be proactive about this. The university is continuing to look to ways to improve prevention and reporting here on campus, and this includes launching training for all the Title IX responsible employees, that's employees who deal regularly with students, developing an ongoing education and awareness campaign regarding sexual harassment and sexual violence, continuing the collaboration between the Title IX coordinator and the Office of Human Resources to improve record keeping, training, and referral processes, and establishing a central reporting system and a database for sexual harassment and sexual assault reports and complaints. That is my news for today. I know that we are rushing towards final exams, and many of you are probably feeling very busy right about now. Winter commencement is going to take place on Sunday, December 17th at 10 a.m., and I hope we'll have good faculty representation. That's always a fun event in the Kohl Center. And after that, I do hope that all of you have a wonderful holiday season. Get a break from everything you've been doing and come back refreshed at the beginning of the next semester. So let me now turn things over to Marcia, and we'll do questions after that. Marcia.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. So it's great to be here. I anticipated potentially a different beginning set of remarks if our research rankings had fallen further, but they did not. So it's great to be here to report on some of the things that my colleagues and I in the research office have been working on in order to not only increase our rankings or stabilize and then increase them in the future, but also to support the research enterprise on campus, which is the most important work that we do. We've been watching the trends and the data very closely, and it's for a number of years UW-Madison has actually been dropping in many by many metrics. And so for the past 3.5 years since the Office of Research was created, we've been trying to do our best to address these issues. And I'll start out with some good news and end with some good news, but the good news that I want to share with you to begin with is that after 4 years where our campus research expenditures had dropped each year on an absolute level, not our rankings, but the absolute level of research expenditures had dropped for 4 years in a row. This past year, we actually went up by 8.3% of an increase by 8.3% in research expenditures. So that's a good leading indicator of where we hope things are going to be moving in the future. So what I'd like to do with my time today is to tell you about some of the work that we've been doing and share with you some examples from our faculty colleagues about how they are taking advantage of some of the new resources that we have in the, made available through the research office. So first and foremost, our goal is to support our faculty in carrying out the what I call the research projects of our dreams. We all know what that means. We all know that if we have many, many ideas that we would love to carry out in research if we only had funding to begin the research or to take it to the next level, and often it's that's the most difficult funding to come by, the funding in the beginning. So you've heard me talk about the UW 2020 program, which we launched in 2016, and the UW 2020 is funded primarily by WARF. And during the first year of UW 2020 funding, we allocated about $9 million to 28 collaborative research projects. Those projects are still ongoing. They're not quite completed, but although they're not completed yet, the $9 million investment has already generated about $11 million in new extramural research funding. And we're very, very pleased about that. And even though grants awarded and research dollars in grant budgets are not the most important metric, obviously it's the knowledge that's generated from these research projects, I just thought that, this early outcome of success bears mentioning and sharing with you, the Faculty Senate. So let me share with you one example of a UW 2020 project from that first round of funding that has already met with success and I think is quite inspiring. It's the group that zoology professor Monica Turner leads, along with her collaborators Tony Ives, Steve Carpenter, Chris Kucharik, and Jack Williams from zoology, limnology, agronomy, and geography. Their UW 20 project is entitled Anticipating Abrupt Ecological Change in the 21st Century. And what they do is they and each of them has recruited a postdoc to work together to co-teach a class, a seminar, and to collaborate on research that's focused on specific ecological hazards, such as harmful algal blooms that occur in over-fertilized lakes or collapsing tree populations or the like. And in addition to developing this new seminar, which has been launched, they also have already obtained 3 new NSF grants totaling $1.8 million, and they have expectations for additional funding in the pipeline. So time doesn't permit me to tell you more stories about UW 2020 projects, but I wish I could because they are just very inspiring, creative ideas that our faculty have brought to us. Each one of them is described on our website, so I encourage you to go to the website and take a look at these if you're interested, and I guarantee that this would be good reading for you. We are about to begin the fourth round of UW 2020 funding in the next month or so, and so we'll have new results to report from that round of funding. The second strategy we've been pursuing to address our falling research enterprise is to advocate for increasing the size of our faculty. At the same time when our peer institutions are increasing their faculty, and they're doing that in part by hiring our faculty, as we know, we have remained more or less flat in terms of the number of faculty that we have here at UW-Madison, and we have fallen behind particularly hiring new faculty. And if you compare 2016 to 2008, which is some years in the Data Digest that were handy, on my shelf, we brought in 25% fewer faculty in 2016 than in 2008. And as we all know, we've lost some truly outstanding faculty to other universities. So working collaboratively with the chancellor, the provost, and the vice chancellor for finance and administration, my office has been advocating for restarting our cluster hiring initiative, which was so exciting when it was first rolled out here at UW-Madison 20 years ago. And some of us remember that, I do. And I feel, sorry, there's a visitor here. Now it's not.
He's gone.
Now he's gone. Things happen, right? So I know that the cluster hiring program has undergone some careful evaluation research, and it turns out to be one of the most successful strategies we've used in the past in terms of hiring really exciting faculty members in new areas for our campus. So I'm very grateful to the chancellor and others, other members of the campus leadership for making the commitment to invest in cluster hiring again. So I thought I would bring a couple of examples from 20 years ago to bring to you today, because as we move toward selecting new clusters for funding, I think that this sets some standards for what we would be looking for to replicate again and to exceed. So one example that of a successful cluster that's near and dear to my heart is the Translational Neuroscience Cluster, which is led by Sushan Zhang, Qiang Cheng, and Xinyu Zhao at the Departments of Neuroscience, Neurology, and Genetics, and they all have affiliations with the Weissman Center. So the goal of this cluster is to advance basic research on neurological diseases and to translate those basic science results into new stem cell approaches to drug discovery and treatments. So just to give you a sense of their broad stroke accomplishments since for the past 16 years, they've worked very closely together. They've trained several generations of graduate students and postdocs. They've created new core facilities, which many of us in this room utilize, as well as many faculty and students across the campus. They've generated $27 million in extramural research funding, $6.3 million in donor funds, 17 patents, and one startup company. So it's a nice record, but they're not alone in generating this amount of success. And I thought another good example to use in illustrating the range of research that can be supported by the cluster program is another cluster that was started 16 years ago, and that's the poverty cluster. There are three current members of the cluster: Catherine Magnuson from Social Work, Tim Smeeting from La Follette, Lydia Ashton from Consumer Science, and a fourth faculty member, Jeff Smith, will be joining the cluster in January. And they have collectively also trained several hundred PhD students in the past 16 years, and the great majority of those students are now tenure-track faculty members working in the area of poverty research at our peer institutions. These cluster faculty have been the recipients of major extramural research awards, major university research awards, including a Romnus for Catherine Magnuson and a Wharf Name Professorship for Tim Smeeting, and their total extramural grants total $16 million, as well as another $15 million for the successfully funded, renewed core grant for the Poverty Institute. And they've published 8 books and well over 100 articles in the top journals of their field. So two very different areas of research yielding significant impacts on graduate education, on research, and on our campus, broadly speaking. So I don't have sufficient time to go on and on, but I could. But I would encourage you to read the 2008 evaluation report of the Cluster Hiring Initiative that's posted on the provost website, because it really lays out some of the hopes and successes of the cluster program in the past. A recently appointed faculty committee led by Vice Provost for Faculty and Staff Michael Bernard Donalds and his colleague Mo Bischoff is currently in the process of reviewing the 48 cluster proposals that were submitted on November 3rd. So stay tuned for the outcome of this review and also for the second round of cluster hiring planned for the spring semester. The third strategy that we've been pursuing in the research office to support and expand UW-Madison's research program is to take stock of our quote-unquote inventory of shared research resources and make this inventory available to the research community. Isabel Gerard on my staff has created a wonderful new website. The Chancellor and I blogged about this website. It's called Resources for Researchers, and it lists at this point nearly 800 shared resources on campus that can be accessed by researchers, graduate students, postdocs in our community. And thus far, since it was launched, which it was launched in June, thus far over 3,000 unique users have come to the site and in order to learn about material and resources they can access, an average of between 25 and 35 new users each day. So it's really taken off. So what's on this website? So usually when we think about resources for researchers, we think about microscopes or MRI scanners or databases. But what Isabel has taken on is creating a website that goes across the entire campus for resources for researchers in the arts and humanities, as well as in the social, biological, and physical sciences. So for example, Assistant Professor Daniel Graboy has listed his electroacoustic music facility on the Resources for Researchers website. It's a space within the School of Music with state-of-the-art tools for the production and recording of electroacoustic music. And it was funded by one of our UW 2020 awards, and it's intended to dramatically improve the opportunities for our faculty to record their music, which is the coin of the realm in music research. Another example that I thought was particularly unique is information on the website that was posted by Professor Gary Diffie and his colleagues from the Department of Kinesiology in the School of Nursing on a human exercise core facility. And it was also launched by a UW 2020 award. So anyone on campus who's interested in conducting research on exercise capacity, exercise metabolism, muscle function, and body composition can turn to the website to learn about the resources that are available in this core facility. But it also makes the offer that anybody interested in carrying out this this area of research, especially people who are new to this research, it will provide training for faculty and graduate students how to access the equipment within the core facility. So in addition to all of that, we're completing this fall's round of the fall competition. And in addition to that, with Dean Karpus, we have allocated WARF funding for graduate students. As you know, we also provide matching funds for significant extramural grant applications. We work with the schools and colleges on startup and recruitment packages and offer bridge funding for those programs that meet certain criteria but have fallen to a period between grant funding. All of these and other strategies that we use in the research office are listed on the VCRGE website, and I encourage you to take a look at them. I'll say one more area of progress, and then I'll finish up. And that area of progress is in the research compliance area. So our goal in that area is to reduce the administrative burdens of research and increase the support that we can provide for our research community. We've been busy benchmarking our peer institutions and are in the process of trying to implement some streamlined approaches in the research compliance area. With support and encouragement from the Chancellor and other campus leaders, this past September we transitioned the Education and Social and Behavioral Sciences IRB Institutional Review Board, charged with overseeing human subjects research, to the research office. This move aligned implementation of our human subjects research program with the responsibility for this important area of compliance. And that responsibility rests with the Associate Vice Chancellor for Research Policy and Compliance, Nadine Connor. She is euphemistically referred to as the go-to-jail person, in case there's a violation. But she is also now the person who is responsible for organizing the most effective human subjects research program. And we are planning to do the same with the Health Sciences IRB. By making these changes, we're hoping to make research more easy to carry out for our faculty members, while at the same time we are upholding the highest ethical standards of the protection of human subjects who are participating in research, eliminating a layer of bureaucracy and more directly implementing increased flexibilities in human subjects research that are in use by our peer institution and are permitted by the federal government. So we're hard at work in trying to make things work better that way. So last year at my report to the Faculty Senate, I reported to you that our office had formally established a new governance committee, and that's called the University Research Council. And the URC, the University Research Council, consists of a mixture of elected faculty, faculty who are appointed by the university committee, academic staff members, and a university staff member. And the University Research Council's function is to advise the research office on all aspects of the research enterprise. So later in today's Senate meeting, a proposal will be introduced by the university committee to retire a Chapter 6 committee that has been inactive for a number of years, and that committee was named the Research Safety and Compliance Oversight Committee. The proposal will be presented to you will be to merge the functions of that committee that has been inactive into the functions of the University Research Council. The URC discussed this proposal at a meeting earlier this fall, and there was a unanimous vote in favor of absorbing the functions of that committee into those of the URC. So this is a heads up for another item in today's Senate agenda that you'll be thinking about. So let me end with a few other positive notes to give us all optimism about where perhaps we are heading in terms of our research program. And I wanted to end on this positive note because there's good news on the horizon. So since 2013, WARF has increased its allocation in support of research and graduate education by 52%. Since 2015, we've seen a 24% increase in the budgets of submitted research proposals for extramural funding. And as we all know, submissions are the leading indicator of awards. Can't submit them, you can't get them. And as I mentioned earlier, we've seen an 8.3%, which translates into $88.6 million. That's an increase in the absolute amount of research expenditures that we made in 2016 over the previous year. And that ends, as I mentioned, a four-year steady decline in research expenditures. So these are indications that things are moving in a good direction. It may be because of some of the new programs that we've started. It's certainly because of all of our colleagues on campus, our faculty colleagues, and the hard work of our graduate students and postdocs and research staff as a collective community. And it's really wonderful to be able to end on a note of optimism after last year, which was not a note of optimism. So thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for either Marcia or myself?
Hi, Noah with Feinstein Community and Environmental Sociology. I have a comment and a question, or a request and a question. The request is, because much of the ongoing efforts to improve our university climate with regard to sexual harassment and sexual violence will take place at the level of smaller units, much of that work will necessarily take place at those levels. As lessons become clearer about best practices at the departmental level, could there be a mechanism for disseminating information about what departments and smaller units should do? I know that would be appreciated in the units of which I am part.
I think that's a great idea, and let's work through the deans and with our compliance officers to try to set that up.
Fantastic. The question is in regards to the possible taxation changes or the threat of those changes. I just want some reassurance that someone in some office somewhere is coming up with some contingency strategies.
So I had a faculty member who wrote me saying, what are we going to do in case, say, graduate school tuition actually gets taxed? And let me be quite clear that this is the wrong time to be discussing that. Right now, they're in the midst of writing a tax law, and it is probably not smart to stand up and say, well, if you write that law, here's how I'm going to avoid it, because that probably guarantees that you won't be able to do that avoidance. They'll rewrite the law. Now is the time, I think, to be focused on trying to get the best tax rule possible through the House and the Senate. And depending on what comes through, then we need to focus on how we respond.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions? I want to really thank Marcia for all of the work she has done over the last 3 years. And I suspect all of you noticed that she is going to take a family leave for 6 months due to some family illness issues, and that Norman Drinkwater is going to fill in as the interim vice chancellor for research and graduate education. Norman was here a minute ago. Is he still here? Did he leave?
He had another meeting
to go to. But from the 1st of January through the end of May, 1st of June, Norman will be the person that you see in these meetings. And thank you very much, Marcia.
Thank you.
All right. If you turn in your packet to the minutes of November 6th, are there any additions or corrections? If there are not, I'm going to approve the minutes as distributed, and we'll turn to the next item and recognize Professor Peter Miller, who will present the annual report from the Athletic Board. Pete.
Thanks, Chancellor Blank. We're going to just talk briefly about some key parts of the last year's academic year with regard to the activity of the Athletic Board. I had started as chair of the Athletic Board this past summer. So the board is made up of 23 voting members, diverse parts of campus on the board. Most of the work of the board operates through these committees. So we have a personnel committee, a finance facilities and operations committee, an equity, diversity, and student welfare committee, and an academics and compliance committee. So I'll talk briefly about those items here today. A couple of the main points, you know, as the athletic board, we focus mostly on academics and kind of the integrity issues associated with athletics. So when it comes to academics, you know, we look at how our students are performing relative to the past, how our students have done over the years, and then also how they're doing relative to our peers in our conference and throughout the country. So last year, our data around those areas looked pretty good. So just it's hard to see those things on the bottom there, but the cumulative GPA of all student athletes at UW, which is over 800 of them, was 3.07 at the end of the spring 2017 semester. 331 student athletes on the dean's list, dean's honor list, or dean's high honor list. One issue that we find, and we've heard about in other institutions, is academic clustering, where student athletes are kind of pushed into certain majors and not afforded opportunities to go into others. So at this institution, it's promising to see that we have student athletes in 90 different academic majors, which is a really kind of encouraging thing to say. We have to see. We have certain areas that are most common, but we have 72 majors that have 10 or fewer student athletes. So it's just to show that we have quite a distribution within those who compete in athletics and what they're studying. As Chancellor Blank shared about the academic achievements of our football team in the top five nationally for five straight years in terms of their academics, we also have a number of other teams that have performed really high in that regard. So in the top 10% of all Division I teams, all of these teams did that. They achieved that highly. So that's promising. As a board, one of the things we're really trying to keep an eye on is how are the students performing academically. So this is data that we work closely with the academic services and learning about. The other area that we spend a lot of time as a board, and we have a number of board members here, is to make sure around compliance matters and kind of institutional integrity matters. There are all kinds of violations. The NCAA rulebook is over 300 pages, and there's a lot of rules from level 1 to level 4. So last year, our athletic program had 21 what you could call very minor violations, and those are like really, really kind of nitpicky things that are, it's some of them surprising that they're even violations. But the more encouraging number is we had zero big violations. So there were no kind of major, what the NCAA would call kind of major scandals, which is as a board, something that we're especially concerned about. This is a chart that's hard to see, but we showed something like this last year. It's the annual review. There's a bunch of schools below the x-axis. This is from the Wall Street Journal. The x-axis shows, you know, how strong you are in competition. So if you're farther to the right, you're, you know, really doing well, winning games. The y-axis shows what they call admirability, and on the bottom is called the embarrassing scale. So if you see, there's only one school that's slightly off the admirability chart, and that's Wisconsin. So as a board, we're very proud to see this with regard to that. So along with student welfare issues, these are some of the other things we look at, just kind of the day-to-day wellness of our student athletes, students, to make sure that they have a well-rounded college experience and they're able to do things other than just be training We want them to be able to spend time in class. We want them to be able to have a holistic college experience, and we learn about these things with the athletic department staff. Looking forward, what are the big things on our horizon? We want to continue to focus on academics and student welfare of those 800 students. We also want to, you know, outside of Wisconsin, there's a lot of change possibly pending in college athletics in terms of how it's governed, how it's overseen. We want to make sure we kind of monitor that horizon, and we're ready for any changes that might come. So that's a brief report for the athletic board, and it's a wonderful group to work with. A number of us are here, and so thank you for your service. And do we have time for questions?
Are there any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Right. Thanks to the whole athletic board for the work they do. You're now on page 10 of your booklet, and I'm going to recognize Professor David McCorlier, who's going to present the annual report of the Campus Transportation Committee.
Thank you, Chancellor Blank. I'll keep this very, very brief. I'd refer you to faculty document 2712, which is our 2016-2017 annual report of the Campus Transportation Committee. The highlight of this is our continuing interest in trying to match demand with operating costs for parking. We're moving from 3 to 2 permit rates, and those of you who do have parking permits have noticed that. It's a 6-year effort to try to bring these two in closer alignment with the amount of money we pay for parking. This is in addition to transportation demand management initiatives that we've been taking on. So with that, I guess I'll open it up for any questions.
Chad Allen Goldberg, District 71. I was interested to see in the report that at the March 10th meeting, Peter Van Kan expressed concerns about a 50% increase in the cost of the employee bus pass, and noted that was a much higher percentage than previous increases, and he also felt that might discourage employees to use the bus and might have a greater impact on lower paid employees. I have to say that I share all of those concerns, and so my question is, how does the committee plan to address those concerns?
Good question. We have increased bus passes on an annual basis to $36. And I guess I'll just point out that a monthly bus pass, it's highly subsidized, right? So a monthly bus pass is $65, an annual bus pass is $780. So this is still a good bargain. What we were trying to do as a committee was to try to reduce the aspect of it being free. And people would, in the past, get a free bus pass and not use it. So charging $36 a year seemed to be a reasonable increase to a highly subsidized program.
Channel on Goldberg, District 71. I understand that, I appreciate that. I don't think that really answered my question. I am wondering whether there will be any attempt to address those concerns. I'm also curious, Peter Van Kan made a motion to amend the program changes, which was voted down, and I'm curious what the content of that amendment would have been.
Good question. I can't really recall this. I'm sorry, I can't answer your question.
What if you check that information back to Chad?
Sure. How about if I do that? So,
yeah. Good. Anyone else? Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thanks to you and your committee for your work. Let me recognize Professor Dorothy Farrar-Edwards, who's going to present the Prof's annual report found on page 15 of your materials.
Thank you, Chancellor. I'm here to present just a brief overview of the Prof's report, which is included in your documents for today's meeting. I want to remind you that Prof's is a voluntary membership organization created by this body, and we represent the faculty of this university on a number of different issues. The university committee is the board of directors, and we have a steering committee. And at this point, it's really important for me to recognize the former president of the steering committee. Everyone knows Judith Burstyn. If you don't, you haven't been on campus for very long. But I want to say that Judith worked tirelessly for all faculty members through profs, and we can't do enough to thank her. I didn't realize how much she did until I stepped into this job. I want to say that even though she stepped out of the position as president and stepped into the role as chair of the chemistry department, which is a very demanding position, she's always available. She doesn't miss the meetings. She's available. And she's just an incredible supporter. And so what does Profs do? It's really important that you understand that Profs is your legislative arm. We are currently monitoring and tracking 13 different bills. Jack O'Mara, who's in the back of the room, is our representative. I want to thank every faculty member who's taken the time and the effort to go up and speak to legislators. It's really, really important that we have a presence in the Capitol and that we are not always talking about the budget. I think the legislators are surprised to hear from faculty members about the research that they're doing and the perspectives we have on really important things going on in the state. So we're trying actually to increase our presence in the Capitol. And particularly in an off-budget year, it's particularly important. So if we call you and ask you, I hope you'll make the time to go because it's really important. There are four different pieces of legislation I just want to briefly mention. A number of faculty and Dean Golden went up and did testimony on the fetal tissue bill, which fortunately was not introduced. We were able to help head that off. The campus free speech bill, important to all of us, has attracted a lot of attention. We had faculty members speaking about that. We have a bill making its way, hopefully, to the floor, fondly known as the Mark Cook Bill by us, but maybe also known as the Mark Cook Bill in the legislature, and that's to really free us from some of the current restrictions on entrepreneurial activity. And there was legislative discussion on self-insurance, which fortunately was defeated by the Joint Finance Committee. So I want to encourage you, if you don't belong, to please join. If you're asked to come and speak, please speak, and to otherwise support our activities. Thank you.
Are there questions for Dorothy? Thank you very much. Let me recognize Professor John Baldacchino, Director of the Arts Institute. He's going to report on proposed changes to the Institute for Informational Purposes. Let me note these changes have been approved by the UAPC, and the final step to finalize them is a report to the Senate on the changes. You don't get to vote, but you do have to listen to the report. John.
Thank you, Chancellor. I refer to the document 2714 that you have been sent, and I would like to read a paragraph for that, which is very succinct. It's best put, actually, than ever I would put it myself. So these proposed changes stem from the conviction that the Division of the Arts should possess the authority, visibility, autonomy, and resources commensurate with the role as the chief unit within the Office of the Provost, responsible for connecting the arts within a vital and vibrant research university. In line with other divisions of in the Provost's office, the Arts Institute will be renamed the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Division of the Arts. The name also reflects the division's centrality as a coordinator or sponsor of arts research, collaborative and interdisciplinary teaching and learning, and outreach service on campus and on a national and global scale. The other little detail is that we are often confused with the Arts Institute in Chicago. And as you know, the Arts Institute in Chicago is a very different kind of thing. Now, just to give you a notion of what we do here, so that you can understand why, actually, this move is very important for us, I just want to give you some recent information. For example, we have a 20-year ongoing interdisciplinary arts program, which is a residency program that actually attracted and recruited some of our finest faculty in the university. This spring, we have Sharon Ray, who is a British-American artist. She comes from the Caribbean. She is specialized in, I would say, African aesthetics, and she is a performer of international caliber. In the fall, we have Stuart Flack, who is based in Chicago. He is going to be working with the Boltz Institute, which is actually, as you know, very much involved in entrepreneurial arts and arts administration. And then in the spring, 19, we have Rashad Newson, who is actually an African-American artist of high repute and international standing. We have also been developing, especially since I came here, and this is one of my kind of parts of my vision for the institute or the division, is that we have developed a lot of work in arts research. This Thursday, we have our first Arts Agon, which is the Arts Research Forum, which is going to present five artists, but one of them actually is a group of students who are working from across the disciplines on comics and the visualization of art and arts research. We're also become members of ELIA, which is the European Alliance for the Arts, the European League for the Institute of the Arts, and we presented in London just last summer. And we were highly noted. And in fact, actually, I'm going to meet ELIA's president. She's based in Rotterdam this holiday. We also are members of the Alliance for the Arts, which is A2RU, and we play a very vital role in that. And we're also members of ICFAD, which is the International Conference for Arts Deans. Again, we play a central role in that and represent the arts. We also have an Arts Awards, which we administer, on behalf of of the university donors, I should say, not ours. And that actually distributes up to $90,000 to our faculty. We have just hired a grants administrator intended to help us develop and also identify external sources of funding and help also our faculty to get together across the arts and across disciplines to go for these grants. Should remind you that the Film Festival, which is a very important event, generates over $1.3 million for the community. That is in terms of community business. But more importantly, and I'm very proud of this, we do sponsor the studio, which is a freshman's program, works in residency, and also it is very centrally focused on the issue of diversity. It's one of the most diverse groups that we have in the university. And I would say that the Arts Institute, actually, or the Arts Division, is very much on the forefront of expanding and developing the notion of diversity through the arts. That's just a little kind of taster of what we do. Our yearly report is out there now, it's online. And so if you have any questions, please.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, John. We now have a number of proposed changes to different parts of FPNP, and let me call upon Professor Anya Warner, who's going to present proposed changes to Chapter 4 for a first reading. So no vote, just conversation.
Thank you, Chancellor. Good afternoon. So the first of these several items, as the Chancellor said, is just for first reading. You have in your materials faculty document 2715, which is a proposal to create a new FPNP section about the Divisional Committee Review Council, or DCRC. This was necessitated by our post-tenure review policy, which makes reference to this DCRC, which doesn't exist yet. The DCRC is intended to provide faculty input on post-tenure review cases where the departmental review and the dean's review are in disagreement. In those cases, the provost must decide whether remediation is in order. Prior to making that determination, she must confer with the DCRC. That's what our post-tenure review policy says. The DCRC would consist of four faculty members, one from each faculty division selected by divisional committees. And people who would serve on the DCRC would be faculty members who previously served on divisional committees. Provost Mangelsdorf has indicated that this body may be able to provide her counsel on other tenure-related matters, so this proposed new FPNP section 4.40 has been written more broadly than just for post-tenure review. You will also note that this change will require a small change to Chapter 6. Given that the DCRC provides a recommendation to the provost, its decisions do not stand alone and thus are not subject to appeal or review. I look forward to your input on this first reading.
Comments now are as you read through this and you or any of your colleagues have comments, you should obviously send them in to UC between now and our next meeting for the second reading. All right. Let me recognize Professor Anya Wanyer, who is going to present a proposed change to FPP Chapter 6 for our first reading. This is on page 22.
This is about a topic that Vice Chancellor Malik talked about earlier. You have in your materials faculty document 2716, a proposal to roll the functions of the Research Safety and Compliance Oversight Committee into the University Research Council. The former committee, defined in FPMP 658, has been idle for some time. And even when it was more active, it was difficult to keep it staffed. More to the point, it had a hard time executing its charge because it was always peripheral to the units involved. Now that we have a strong shared governance presence directly related to research in the form of the University Research Council, which has 9 faculty members on it, we have an opportunity to ensure that the advice, oversight, and review functions envisioned in the charge of the earlier committee are taken seriously and issues are dealt with appropriately and expeditiously. This is a first reading, and I look forward to your input to this first reading.
Are there questions?
Eric Sandgren, District 113. My department chair, Chuck Saprinsky, was chair of this committee before. And agrees that it was very difficult to accomplish anything because there really was no authority granted to it. He's looked at this and is fully in agreement with this change. He did express some surprise that this was the first he'd heard about it, and I would just suggest remember to discuss with all stakeholders when decisions like this are made.
Point taken, but I'm glad he's in support.
Again, if you or any of your colleagues have comments on this before the next faculty senate meeting, please send them in to Anya and to the UC. Let me now recognize Professor Anya Warner, who is going to present proposed changes to Chapter 11. This is the second time these changes have come to you, so we will be voting on these at the end of the conversation.
I move adoption of faculty document 2707. Which updates Chapter 11 of FPNP, that includes a title change. As explained by Dean Jeff Russell last month, these changes replace a decades-old document that bore little resemblance to how summer instruction happens on this campus. These changes explain summer term administration, compensation, and appointments, and change the title from summer session to summer term. In addition to the changes laid out by Dean Russell last month, we have made 2 further changes based on your input during last month's first reading. First, at the very beginning of 1104, there's a new sentence indicating that any work performed during the summer by 9-month faculty or staff must be voluntary. And second, Section A of 1104 has been changed from an employee may be asked to perform to an employee may agree to perform.
Are there any questions on this document, or are you ready to vote? Chad.
Chad Allen Goldberg, District 71. I should have asked this in our last meeting, but it escaped my attention. Point of information, why is the option for deferral of summer session compensation being eliminated? Why not keep that in the revised version?
Can you point me to where exactly that is?
The old 11.04.
It's entirely eliminated. You need Jeff on this.
Jeff is here, yeah. Is this? Because you crafted most of this document.
So I've been the summer dean for campus for the last 7 years, and we've not utilized this particular provision. This came, I think, long time ago. We at one time did this, but we don't carry over, or we don't have a practice of carrying over funding for courses that are taught in the summer. Now, if a school or college chooses to do that, that's up to them. But as a general practice on campus, we have not done that.
So Chad Allen Goldberg, District 71, point of information. So is that because people aren't aware of the possibility or the option and they don't request that? Or is that because there is no mechanism to allow people to do that even if they would request that?
Well, I see Mark Walters in the back. It's my understanding that one has to align the compensation when the effort is expended. Mark, am I correct? So the notion of us being able to stockpile money to be drawn upon later, at least as a general policy, is not something that we've seen done on campus. But Mark, I think I'm right, right?
Sorry, Chad Allen Goldberg, District 71, point of information. But is that a university policy that was somehow put in place after this portion of FPNP was written, or is there a legal basis for that? That's what I'm trying to understand.
Mark?
This was clearly written somewhere in the 1960s because it refers to 1961 and 1968 as key issues, but yeah.
It is, this is Mark Walters. It's generally a university policy. It is a university policy that when you perform the work, you need to be paid the compensation. So as far as socking it away, that's not what we've been doing.
So one last question. So does that mean that a university policy was put into place that was in violation of FPNP?
I'm not aware of that circumstance.
That's how it appears. Thank you.
Are there any other questions or comments? If not, if you are ready to vote, we need a majority vote on this. All those in favor of approving the changes to Chapter 11 as indicated in your documents indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, no. Any abstentions? The document carries. Let me now recognize Professor Anya Warner, who will present a motion to endorse the new campus sexual harassment and sexual violence policy on page 27 in your documents.
This is where things get a little bit complicated. So this is specifically about the endorsement. So that is just the one-page document. That's faculty document 2709, which is an endorsement of the UW-Madison policy on sexual harassment and sexual violence. So we would just vote, but we to endorse. Next thing then is, depending on how this goes, we will then the policy itself will not be voted on, but we currently have faculty legislation that puts together regulations for harassment and regulations for freedom of speech in the classroom in one chapter, and we would separate that out. So we would then remove the portions about sexual harassment for which we will then have a separate policy out of that chapter, so that that chapter will only deal with freedom of speech in the classroom, so that we don't combine two things that necessarily would not have to be in the same piece of legislation.
So we first are going to have a discussion and a vote on whether you endorse the policy, and depending on how that vote comes out, we will then discuss this next round of changes to faculty legislation 2303. All right, so this conversation is about the policy laid out on page 27. Is there anyone who has any comments on it? I think everyone here should have seen this. Yeah, Judith.
Judith Burston, District 48. So I just have one question, but I believe I know the answer, but I am led to understand from this new change, which is much clearer, that the policy in question is a policy that is campus-wide and is legally necessary and required essentially by federal legislation, and therefore moving this out of FPNP completely, which is what will happen, all we're doing is endorsing the university policy that's legally required, and then it's being removed. Then the second part of the proposal is to remove anything about sexual harassment from FPNP because it's now legally mandated through other frameworks.
That is my understanding. And the only addition I would like to make is that it's not just federal compliance, but we were handed a template by system that we have to comply with also. So there are so many non-movable parts in this policy, and also so many people worked on this policy to combine the non-movable parts with how we want to handle things on campus, that we would like to keep that intact. So we would currently just vote on endorsing that policy that we would then move out of II 203.
Thanks. John Mackay, District 66. My question is sort of related to that one. So I noticed that the proposed policy states in Section 8A, this is at the top of page 5, that when the respondent is a student, the university will use the investigatory and disciplinary procedures set forth in Chapter 17 of the University of Wisconsin Administrative Code, which in turn states at section, where am I? Okay, I didn't bring up the right page, but anyway, what it says essentially, I can summarize if that's okay, that there are 10 possible punishments listed for a disciplinary hearing in general, not just one on sexual misconduct, increasing in levels of severity. And what it states is that the standard of evidence required shall be, there are three clauses. One, it says the standard of evidence shall be the preponderance of evidence if the punishment is one of the 7 less severe ones, and that the standard of evidence shall be clear and convincing evidence if the punishment is one of the 3 most severe, including suspension from a course and expulsion. But then there's a third clause, as it currently stands, stating that the standard of evidence in cases of sexual misconduct shall be just the preponderance of evidence, regardless of whether of what the punishment issued is. Is that all correct?
That is correct. We have been required under federal guidelines to use preponderance of evidence on all sexual violence and assault cases. As of a month ago, we were given discretion to potentially think about changing that to clear and convincing. We are not going to make any changes in the middle of the year because we already have cases in place. You cannot use one disciplinary standard for part of the year and another disciplinary standard for another part of the year. We are almost surely going to have to engage a conversation around this. At this point, that conversation has not started. We have no alternative guidance. All we've been told is that we could make alternative decisions, and virtually every university I know has said at this point in time, they're staying with their current procedures, and we'll talk about this in a longer term basis. But I will tell you, we cannot make changes in the middle of the year when you've got ongoing cases. That would be extremely difficult and open us to all sorts of legal problems.
Okay, thank you. I'm just wondering, John Mackay, District 66, could you be a little bit more specific about what you mean by we need to have a conversation? Are you intending that this question will be brought before some administrative body in the future? And do we know whether the regents are considering addressing this?
I'm going to let our general counsel, Ray Tafora, answer that.
Hi. One of the problems with changing it is that as you read from the code, system would have to change it because that's all in the code. So any changes we'd make would have to go through system processes.
So let me be clear that the reference in the document you're working on simply says the disciplinary processes have to follow the University of Wisconsin Administrative Code. The University of Wisconsin Administrative Code is a system-level code. We do not have our own authority to set this. So this is a conversation that would have to be engaged system-wide. At this point, they have not started that conversation. There is some conversation about whether they're going to start the conversation. I don't know quite where this is going to go. But we do have some leeway that we did not have before.
John Mackay, District 66. Just a point of information. Yeah. Could you clarify what would happen if we did not endorse this policy at this time? What would be the consequence of that?
Because we are legally required to follow this, the policy will go into place in any case, but you would be on record as not approving it.
Okay.
Are there any other questions? All right, let me call for a vote. Again, I believe we need a majority vote on this one. All of those in favor of endorsing the UW-Madison policy on sexual harassment and sexual violence indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Any abstentions? The endorsement carries, and I will now recognize Professor Anya Warner to present a motion to modify faculty legislation 2303.
So this is the second part now. Now that we have accepted or endorsed the policy, we will remove that language from faculty legislation II-303. I move adoption of faculty document 2708 with the following change. The second sentence of document 2708 should read, on a directive from the UW Board of Regents, the UW-Madison Provost Advisory Group on Sexual Assault and Misconduct, PACSAM, constructed the policy contained in faculty document 2709. The changes contained in faculty document 2708 are needed to reflect the fact that you have now endorsed a broader and more detailed policy covering the same material as some of this piece in faculty legislation. As I noted before, these two documents were combined for the first reading last month. With the new policy separated out, this document relates solely to the existing faculty legislation. The motion now on the floor would remove the parts of II-303 relating to sexual misconduct, leaving only the parts related to expression, which in fact constituted the bulk of the original document, and we haven't changed any of that wording. So it's really just about moving out that part that we now don't need anymore.
All right, so this is basically going to make this faculty legislation consistent with the endorsed policy that you've just endorsed. That is now part of full policy. Any comments, questions on this motion? If not, I will call for a vote. All those in favor of the proposed changes to faculty legislation 2303 indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, that carries. At this point, I think we are done with the regular order, and I'm going to ask everyone in the Faculty Senate to stay for a closed session, and everyone who is not in the Faculty Senate to please leave. And I'd like a motion to move into closed session pursuant to Wisconsin Statutes 19.85, 1C and F, to consider the recommendation of the Committee on Honorary Degrees. Is there a motion? A motion from here, and a second from Judith. We need the names. The Senate will now consider the confidential report of the Committee on Honorary Degrees pursuant to Wisconsin Statute 19.85, 1C and F, and under Faculty Policies and Procedures, the report will be heard and considered in executive session. I've now said what I have to say, and as soon as everyone has cleared the room, we will move into conversation. Can I have a motion to reconvene in open session? Do I have a second? I need the names and these two. All right. Do I have to vote on this? Yeah, I need a vote to reconvene in open session. All in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. In that case, the meeting is back in open session. I declare it adjourned. Please do not leave until you have issued your vote and turned it in.